This is Geek Speak with Lyle Troxell. This is a show exploring the intersection of humanity and technology, coming from the fringes of Silicon Valley.
This is Geek Speak, and in our endeavor to learn how to manage and run companies better, we have Nate Walkingshaw, who has a recent book with other authors as well, Richard Banfield and Martin Erickson, Product Leadership, How Top Product Managers Launch Awesome Products and Build Successful Teams. Nate Walkingshaw, thank you and welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, man. Thanks so much. I love it. This is going to be great.
So you have a history as a paramedic and did some invention as a paramedic? Tell me.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I started out as an emergency medical technician in Salt Lake City, Utah. That's kind of the whole entire impetus or origin story for why I probably ended up at Pluralsight. It's a very long journey, but yeah, I sat 5 years in the fire and EMS space, in the midst of patient care. It's actually something that I miss a lot. So I think, you know, when this chapter is all done in software development and technology, I think I probably will definitely go back into serving patients.
Now, at Pluralsight, you're actually a chief experience officer, which I guess kind of is like a design officer in a more traditional form.
Yeah, I mean, I started out as the chief product officer, which was running product management and user experience design. And just the origin story of Pluralsight when I got here, I mean, there's only 8 engineers. So it's pretty small. There really wasn't any product management. User experience design was really thought of. And it had a tremendous amount of success, up until that point. But when I got here, when we started thinking about our product, thinking about our experience and thinking about how we would best serve, our customer, mm-hmm. My role evolved. And the role now as chief experience officer really has product management, UX design, engineering, and content all within it today. So it started out, with a pretty small subset, but then as we started to see those problems, we knew that we need to encapsulate all of those human beings to deliver the best product to the market.
Yeah, so Pluralsight, I mean, I'll try to do a quick synopsis and you can correct me where I'm wrong, but Pluralsight's kind of become the training center for the world, right? It's up there. I think it's kind of the biggest offering right now for online training in professional workspace. And so you're an education facility kind of, and what you're saying is that your content, which of course would be your classes and resources for learning and your application design and user experience design from that perspective are kind of under one umbrella under you.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. And Pluralsight, I mean, we're the world's largest developer, IT, and creative training library. Like, you're not going to see us forge into new and emerging areas like Lynda, for instance, in any other training that you would see. And like a lot of those companies like Skillsoft or someone else would do like sexual harassment training, for instance. Like, you won't ever see us going into HR specific topic areas. We're really just focused 100% in tech. Like, we really care a ton about the technology landscape a ton.
In both design and development in tech, but also in business perspective from tech as well?
Yeah, think about it like this. So for the technical skills, the hard skills that a developer would need, if you think about all the way through the leadership stack within a company, so if you had a tech lead, a dev manager, a VP of engineering, a CIO, a CTO, same thing in IT, same thing in creative, we care a ton about, one, the hard skills, so taking a developer from novice to proficient. We also care about giving all the soft skills around technology to manage technology teams. And then we also care about users of technology. So I'm a CIO and I have to do a Salesforce implementation. And so we, we'll build the training library out to make sure that we can encompass those.
The running of a tech infrastructure, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. So, it's an organization that's on-prem to the cloud, so if they want to do an AWS implementation, we feel like we're the best library in the world to, do all that tool chain switch.
What do you think of boot camps?
Yeah, boot camps are incredible. We've partnered with boot camps for a very long time. So I think the thing that we see and And I think, I mean, you work at Netflix, man, so this problem's pervasive across our entire space, especially around technology. Is, look, 50% of what I know today, 2 years from now, is irrelevant. And so, like, what the technologist needs today, you know, is something that gives them, you know, I think whatever current in their context is and relevant in their context is, they have to have all the technical skills in order to do their job. And so, you know, probably the problem that exists for boot camps is that it's the reoccurring knowledge that needs to happen. The biggest piece to that is instructor-led training, ILT. So a person that stands up in front of a classroom in front of like 40 engineers, right, they don't know that person's learning style. It's not self-paced, right? It's a pretty rigorous curriculum. And so I think that's the challenge that faces that marketplace. You know, and so, you know, we care a ton about one, personalized learning, and then two, the ongoing learner's journey, and then making sure that our content is current and relevant in the context of the things that they need to learn.
For online learning, how does a student get that personalized interaction that you kind of reference is important?
Yeah, like I said, you and I have a lot of parallels here, but you know, we've really invested in, you know, machine learning. So our recommendations algorithm based off of human behaviors is a big piece. So, you know, when somebody takes an adaptive skill measurement, a skill IQ, if somebody takes, you know, starts watching a course, if people have a live mentoring session, you know, Iris is our, you know, is our engine that's underneath all that. You know, it's capturing all that information and serving up a very personalized experience based off of someone's learning style. So for instance, you know, if, you know, you might be a high focus learner, I might be a just in time learner, right? You and I will both watch 6 hours of content, but I might watch 360 clips of content, whereas you might watch 6 hours of content end to end. So Iris would know, like, you know, someone's a novice, a proficient, you know, or an expert. Like an expert, like, would exhibit behaviors that would look like just in time learning. Like they already are an expert. They're just looking for an answer to a question, like what Stack Overflow would give them, right? Versus like a novice would be like diving into a new and emerging technology and really, you know, really need to know a ton about the technology in order for them to comprehend it, understand it, and then actually effectively apply it.
How does Iris judge success?
Some of that's proprietary, but what I would tell you is that there's two factors. The two factors is, we care a ton about the time it takes someone to learn. And just so you know, like the time that it takes someone to learn doesn't have really anything to do with speed, right? It's, you know, for them to actually comprehend it, it's really the second variable, which is the time to effectively apply learning.
Yeah.
So somebody, you know, somebody might take 6 months or 6 seconds, but it's the application of their knowledge is what we really care the most about. And I think Iris, you know, is, you know, if you're inside of her brain looking out, it likes to infer different behaviors that would show you how effectively somebody applies that learning.
Okay, that's one. What's the other one?
Well, time to learn is the first one.
Oh, I see.
Which is really an output. Yeah, which is really an output. Like the time that it takes someone to learn is like great, but if they don't use it, if they don't do anything with the knowledge, right, then that's not very useful to them and probably to the companies that they work for. But mostly, like our heart and soul sits around the learner's mindset, or, you know, the learner's ability to take on knowledge and then apply it that helps them better their life.
Okay, so when we're talking about the ability, the time to learn, or the effectively applying learning, does that mean on tests at the end of courses, like a traditional school?
No.
What does it mean then?
Well, no, not at all. So, so Skill IQ, for instance, you know, Skill IQ is meant to be like actually pretty quick. So within, you know, 5 minutes, 25 test questions, like you'll get a skill IQ score. That's great. That'll give you a novice to proficient to expert range. What we care more about is the gap in that knowledge. So they didn't have to go through and watch 30, 40 hours of content. You know, it clips them out of all of that content and then customizes learning specifically based off the gaps they personally have.
Okay.
And then two, once they've accomplished that, then we, you know, we want to make sure that they go apply it some way. And one way to measure that, right, would be like in commits, like you go look at commit history and product code.
And so your company is taking a look at product code Are they suggested to work on a project?
Yeah. So projects is a big piece of our ecosystem. So did you know we bought Code School, right?
I heard that you bought Code School, and that's actually how I kind of started paying more attention to you guys. Because Code School's a longtime friend of the show. We've had them on before, and I really thought their methodology was pretty cool. And I see that you're continuing their courses.
Yeah, that's right.
Or at least so far.
Yeah, I mean, the commitment to... Yeah. Well, the commitment, I think we want a unified user experience. And so that Code School team is obviously they're brilliant. That whole entire crew is super brilliant. So when you think about anything software developer, as far as projects, like practically applied knowledge, you can't really get any better than the Code School crew. So, that's really who owns the TTEAL, the time to effectively apply learning.
Oh, interesting. So you've really integrated them as a core feature of the company at this point. The thing about Code School's courses was they were highly... the content was highly integrated with this course. So in my world at Netflix, I work on interactive content, and normally we target a few shows. Like, we've released a couple branching narrative titles, and that content, there's a lot of extra content that's specific to that one show, unlike other content on our service, right? Most of the time you open up Netflix and you browse through the navigation system and you take a look at different movies. Though there's different box art and text around every show, that's it. That's unique, right? And maybe a trailer.
That's right.
Everything else is very generic across the service.
Yep.
Code School methodology was, if you think of a course like a show, if you kind of do that, and the Code School courses had this whole thematic element that was completely integrated with the design, and that's an expensive development process to go through. Are you rolling back on that, or trying to make that more templatized? How are you tackling that?
Well, I don't think it's rolling back on it. I think, one thing that you can recognize is that, not uncommon to Netflix, the Code School analogy was all about big releases. Like, we would look at big language framework tool or process releases like Angular, Angular 2, Angular 4, right? Like, you'd see massive releases behind those technologies, and then you'd watch all of them rush in, right, to learn that tech stack, right? And then they would potentially all rush out, or they would wait for the next big movie release. I think the thing that we'd want to know too is that maintaining, right, that code base for sustained periods of time also got interesting for us. So the thing that we learned pretty quickly is that Pluralsight always wanted to have an approach around originals. So just like Netflix originals, for instance, Pluralsight originals is that we know that we're kind of the single source of truth around a neutral third party's perspective on, what Angular 4, because our author base, right, is real subject matter experts. They're not a talking head. They're actually the people that are writing the language. And so we always wanted to make sure that we were committed to, the original, like, how does this actually happen for developers? So and this is like what I think the slight adjustment is going to be. The adjustment for us in our experience is, one, you'll see it still like launch the Angular 4 project, and it'll be through the traditional paths. I think the thing that's unique though is the opportunity, right, to do a custom project in the context of a company or in the context of an individual learner, mm-hmm. where they want to fork their own repo, right? And then they want us to be able to run tests against their own project, right? And then help that person all the way through, which is what we're calling guided projects. And so we're being a little bit more explicit about what that might look like for a company and for an individual learner versus like the originals paths that you've always seen from Code School.
So for Code School, for example, Google went ahead and put some money forward, and that's where the first Angular course came from, a bit of support from Google, because, mm-hmm. of course, they're trying to advance their Angular. Angular, of course, for my audience that's not JavaScript developers, is a JavaScript framework. It's an older one. There's now Angular 2, and it competes. You might have heard of the terms like Ember and React. React's kind of the hot new hotness now. Comes out of Facebook.
Yeah.
So Google kind of gave some money to Code School and said, hey, we want this learning mechanism. We want more people to learn. And the really wonderful project came out of this course about Angular.
Yeah.
And it's done with the people that in collaboration with the people that actually developed Angular, which is very cool.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying, this other methodology was, you take a company like that, and Google might have done that, but also then said, hey, and we have this internal project, which is like some tools, and we have like 14 engineers on it. And we want these engineers, we want you guys to actually be like using your metrics against our commit history on this project to assess whether the 14 people who are students and also developers are learning the processes in Angular. Is that kind of right?
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's exactly right. Yeah. So think about this, like think about that problem, but on a massive scale. So like if I'm at any other enterprise corporation, for instance, they might have used Angular, not only the people that created Angular, which is a partnership, you know, that we wanted to create, but think about any other company that exists in the marketplace today. They also are using Angular in their own context. Mm-hmm. And they also have to onboard, hire new engineers, right? They've got to put them through a testing framework, yada, yada, yada. So like you see the advantage of like being able to see how other developers other companies use Angular in that framework is really, really useful.
So are you saying that your analysis system, Iris, actually takes a look at commit history on projects? I'm assuming only open source projects, or can it run internal to a network of a business?
No, I mean, Iris isn't doing that today, okay. But we are looking at commit history and projects, yeah.
Oh, interesting. I'd assume that it's very hard to suss out knowledge from commit history.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's, yeah. I mean, the single source of truth there is did you roll it back or not, right?
Yeah. I've seen, like, boot camps lots of times will talk about, you know, we're talking about a kind of entry to a development process, right? You might be a JavaScript developer, and then you take a boot camp on Ruby, and all of a sudden you spend 3 weeks, and now you kind of know what you're doing in Ruby. You might get hired and stuff. Lots of times those boot camps assess their success by hiring status, you know, how many of their students actually went and got hired from someplace. Do you guys do that kind of thing as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an angle that we look at. I mean, it's an angle we hear all the time, but we really don't have a huge focus or emphasis around today, even though we're asked or towed into those conversations all the way. I'll tell you where the origin story really starts, and I'd love to get your perspective on this too. But I mean, most of the customers that we interact or deal with, they're really going through two big changes. One is a catchphrase that you and I can both laugh about, is this thing called the digital transformation. The other one is, you know, the path or the organizational design toward agile, like they want to become, a more agile organization. And so what happens is that you've got huge HR and recruiting teams out there, like scoping roles, which you and I could both Google, right, as the top 10 most popular developer roles around the country. And like, that's basically their recruiting times trying to knock those roles down. So that's the way we kind of get drawn into those conversations from time to time. But really, at the end of the day, they're trying to figure out how to organize a whole group of human beings, right, to then deliver that technology that would have them stay, you know, competitive in nature. And so that's one, that's a skills issue. And then it's also an organizational design issue. And so they're trying to work through both of those landscapes.
Okay. Let me ask you, what's the hardest thing on online learning? Hardest thing to tackle from a design product management perspective?
We're maybe two or three clicks into it right now. When I first got here 3 years ago, I mean, the data science and engineering team is who helped us bridge this gap, is that when we looked at people viewing content, we had one, no idea who they were. And then two, we had no idea how they learned. And three, we didn't know what goals they were trying to accomplish.
Right. They might just be having fun.
Yeah, that's right. And so I think being really explicit about learning outcomes was the biggest learning for us, was like, where are people trying to take them, like their knowledge, and why?
So do you ask them that?
Yeah. So I think our courses, if you look at our skill paths today, like we care a ton about what you get from it, like the learning outcome from it. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the composition between the clips, the modules, the courses and the path and the instructors really do a nice job setting up the course now on what you're going to get out of it. Like Simon Allardyce's course on what is programming is a really awesome course for us, because there's a bunch of non-technical people that exist in an organization that needs to understand what programming languages are. And that's the outcome. They actually understand what programming is, super useful. Right. And then, you know, you have something that's like super, super technical that they actually understand how to deploy, which is, you know, something more specific around the theme on-prem to the cloud. And they want to double click into AWS and then all the languages, frameworks, tools, and processes surround the tool chain switching that enables a company to do that over the course of time.
Yeah, it sounds like kind of an invaluable service for a certain type of developer or business. Let's back to something simple like introduction to person. They don't have any computer science history at all, and they just step into like this intro to programming, what programming languages are, of course. What's the instructor?
Oh, Simon Allardyce.
So Simon Allardyce class. Yep. And so they sign up for this, and their first thing is to kind of get you kind of assess them first off, or what's the first step in the course to find out these people? Because of course it might be someone like me that knows a lot about programming languages, just wants to see what the course is like. Yeah. Might be someone that really is a novice. So how do you learn that?
Yeah. So that's SkillIQ. So today, if you log into our experience, and you go to Skill Paths, you'll see, you know, a list of, let's call it 200 different paths from dev, IT, and creative. And you'll just pick it, like you'll pick, any one of those skill paths you'd like on that page. Up in the upper right-hand corner of that page layout is, you know, you can take a skill IQ test. So within 5 minutes, 25 test questions, where you item response theory, Bayesian, right? And you go through this whole testing, process, and you get a skill IQ score that picks you from novice to expert. The best part about that is that it also just gives you all of the gaps that you have in your knowledge right into that path.
Nice.
And so that's the first thing that you do right out of the gate, and then you start learning.
So someone like me might go, oh, I see those holes and go, oh, there's a few areas, and I could skip to that course area that would just be applicable for me. And then someone who's a novice might see the entire thing from there on out.
That's exactly right.
And what does Iris do?
Yeah, so Iris then, right, is looking at all the clips, the modules, right, the courses that you're viewing, and then when you come back to your home 2.0 experience, that whole thing has been personalized based off of, one, the way that you learn, the content types that you looked at. And so you pick up, one, right where you left off. And then two, it might slice and dice that content specifically, like on 30-second clips, because you really don't watch content, you know, for 6 hours. You watch content in 30-second or 1 minute little bits and jokes.
Nice. Okay. So Iris, I'm assuming you don't want to go too detailed into what Iris is and how it works directly, but it's a machine learning algorithm that takes up singles on all the people that have gone through the courses before, what their learning changes were over time, how much time they spent on all things, and then tries to assess pools of types of people and then place new people into those pools so that it's as close as it can be to what would work for you.
That's exactly right. Yep.
How many developers are you guys seeing per month, active user kind of thing? Or is that private?
I don't know. I can't.
I do that. That happens to me all the time too. People ask me questions and I always, at Netflix, we've got a lot of internal knowledge as developers. We kind of know executive level stuff all the time. We have a lot of data, which is really cool. And it's powerful. It's also a little risky, of course. So I go on my podcast and we start talking about like numbers in Netflix, and I pull numbers out from 6 months ago because I know at least those are public, right? Like I can never kind of give contemporary knowledge because I don't know which is what's public and what's not. So totally understand that. Well, let's talk a bit about your book. This book, of course, is about leadership, and you actually kind of denote something that's pretty early on. You talk about leadership versus management. Can you tell me a bit about what the difference is of those?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a much broader theme for me. You know, the heart and soul of this is, I feel like we're authoring the pages of something really special. And I don't mean my book. Like, the book isn't, like, the book is great. But I just think us as technologists, us as, the authors of the technology thing that's happening to us right now, like, we don't fully know. The example I always give, like, you know, some person walked out into a cotton field and they took a cotton ball and turned it into this thing that you and I wear every day, which is called the textile industry. And that was the Industrial Revolution. You have the cotton gin, the cotton ginny, the sewing machine. Like, I look at this as like, look, I've got these different stacks of technology. I've got AI, I've got mixed reality, I've got VR, I've got all of these ingredients being mixed into this really cool cake right now. And I don't think we really know what it's going to do for the world until maybe 10 or 15 or maybe 20 years from now. But I know it's coming soon. Like, I think it's going to be like, we're really going to see the power of it. And it's going to be awesome. I'm really excited about what's being created. The books at the end of the day is to help what I would say is individual contributors, technology leads, product managers, user experience designers actually have a huge voice at the table. Because for me, the way that I experience this is your technology strategy is your corporate strategy day. Like, that's it to me. It's like, if you do not have someone at the table talking about user experience design, product management, and engineering, along with data science and data engineering, I think it's going to be pretty tough for you to be successful, for a company to be successful every single day right now.
Let's take that back to metaphorically in the Industrial Revolution. What kind of leaders had to be in place for those companies to succeed?
Well, I think those leaders were born. I think that's perfectly, like, that's actually a perfect analogy, is that I don't think they really knew who those leaders needed to be until after everything was kind of stood up. That's kind of I feel like we do have some core frameworks that are stood up, and we need to start bringing the leaders into those conversations. And I'm talking like in the boardroom, mm-hmm. And at a C-level executive team. Like, I think my position right now is fairly rare. Like, you don't see a C-level executive that manages, you know, I think the vast array of technologies that have maybe as much opinion or influence on the company's strategic direction or where it should go over time. And I think that angle, you know, at the boardroom and then also at the, you know, at the C-suite table is having a huge impact on whether a company stays current or relevant in the market. I mean, look at the New York Stock Exchange today. And I think you probably know this, but like, dude, 50% of those companies that were there gone, mm-hmm. like they're gone because they, you know, they really didn't know how to create an environment that, you know, would keep them at the forefront of being able to adopt a new technology.
Let me try to suss in a little bit here. So in the Industrial Revolution, do you think that you had to have, you know, board positions where they understood mechanical linking systems and steam engine or whatever it was that was necessary? Do you think you had really highly technical people in the boardroom at that time? Because you still had technical problems that had to be solved that were crucial to the company's success.
I see where you're headed here. Yeah, I mean, I think what would be important for them is that they would have to at least know the context of how the sausage gets made.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. Like, if I'm a monolithic web application today, let's say like I'm in .NET and Angular. Mm-hmm. Well, like why would we want to change the technical strategy of the company? And like if we were one of those companies that had been displaced by someone like Facebook or AWS, right? Anyone, right? Like, I would want to know what my possibilities are in order for me to change the direction of the company. So yes, I think that it's really important to be able to have someone technical in the room to speak to why we just got disrupted. And like, I mean, you and I could do payments. Like, we could talk about Stripe or, right. Apple Pay or Google Wallet, like all of those, like those three, like look what those three companies just did to the financial services industry.
Exactly. What is it that you're trying to produce in that space?
I mean, the biggest piece here is to actually see that companies at the end of the day probably need to orientate themselves around a product.
Okay.
And the reason why I say that is because, you know, historically some companies are sales led or operationally led,
right.
or financial led. Very rarely do you see a lot of companies that are product led. Like Atlassian is a prime example. Like, look, I mean, Atlassian is an incredible company, you know, who's really a product led or a mission led company. And then those things kind of rotate around it. Product leadership, I think, is really calling specificity to what, you know, product management, UX design, and technology can give back to the company to,
right.
to, you know, enact speed to value.
So as an example, to give more light about what you're saying, some company, a traditional company like a mattress company, their focus point might not be the product itself. It might be more what allows a sales team to successfully sell mattresses. It might not be about better mattresses or anything. It might really be about, well, you know, if we do change the foam style and it's a different feel to it when it's exposed, or what the mattress looks like when it's cut in half, because the, you know, that really wows the customer come in. All that's kind of a marketing and sales strategy. And you could see a company being highly successful, as mattress companies are, doing exactly that, even though the product people might not even be in the room when they're talking about these things.
That's exactly right.
Okay. All right. So you're really giving this book to leaders and people, developers, to kind of think differently about how you focus a company, how you shift a company into that focus. It's interesting. Your position, I don't know if it's chief product officer. Is that specifically right?
Chief experience officer.
Yeah. Experience officer. Yeah. And of course, experience kind of denotes product experience, but also for your course experiences. I think at Netflix, we have a chief product officer. That is a key person in the company. And I think that one of those successes that you see with these companies that are highly focused on producing a good product, and that's all the company's doing in some sense, is making that good product, that of course, that's the single most important thing of the business. And I look at some company like Google, who has high success with lots of different strategies, and, you know, 2 years ago split into multiple companies to kind of allow, I'm assuming, the company to operate at a more product focused rather than a smorgasbord of effect, which they'd been doing for years.
Yeah.
But that's just my guess. So tell me, how do you kind of suggest to people, let's give some hints from your book and kind of get a flavor from the kind of way you speak about it. I don't know what part of the book you wrote and what your colleagues wrote, but I'm sure you're fairly familiar with it in general. Yeah. Let's talk about this idea of product is people.
Yeah. Oh man. I could go on for days. I could go on for days.
You can only do this for 10 minutes.
I know. The short and quick answer is, look, the process by which a company develops its product, I think, is the direct outcome of how successful their product might be. And the reason why I mean that is that, you know, people, human beings, us, you know, the people within the four walls of Pluralsight, like, we're making qualitative, initially, we're making qualitative decisions based off of like a product that somebody might love. You know, and then at the end of the day, like, I'm going to ship a product and then we're going to find out if they use it or not. Like, the funny analogy I like to always tease out is I use this thing called the lawnmower analogy. Like, I could get a lawnmower away to like 1,000 different individual users, right? And everyone would use a lawnmower, you know, differently. The thing is like, we have to organize people within these companies that have a set of scaffolding or a set of frameworks that allows them to qualitatively and qualitatively understand, like, are they going to be successful when they launch a product to market? Like, what's the likelihood of success? And so when I talk about, you know, product as people, is that people come to the table naturally with confirmation bias. Like, they have an opinion. They take you know, a position on how something should be done. The user ultimately breaks the tie for us, though. Mm. Like, how usable it is, right? And if they're willing to pay money for it, and if they're happy, like, that all gets happened. Like, when we ship an experience, like, the user breaks the tie. And so what's really useful is that when somebody develops a product and then they release it to market, like, man, you want to put people as close as you possibly can to see customer relation or to see customer disinterest. And that's really useful back to the people who are developing the product, because once you can see that, especially a developer, especially a product manager, user experience designer, it takes the bias out of it or rids it as much as you possibly can. Because if you put yourself in the middle of it and then you release it and it fails and that was on you, you know what not to do next time. And so if you look at cross-functional teams, if you look at the way they work together, and like, each team has a nuance, like, every team and how they work and how they build, they understand how each other works together. And they also understand that they might have, you know, bias toward one situation or other. And it just gets it completely off the table. Like, once they see it out in the world and they see how human beings interact with what they built, and they get to see all that feedback and synthesize it, and they understand what they did to develop either the success or the failure, that's why it makes really beautiful people in it. And like, that's what I love about product management and, you know, developing products, is because it makes them better human beings, man.
Makes the developer a better human being?
Oh yeah, I think absolutely. Because like, look, this is one thing that people don't understand around the developer community, is that, you know, developers, just like user experience designers, and this is why I think this conversation is so valuable, is, you know, they're writing logic underneath that code. Like, I can give you a bunch of screens. Well, they have to stitch the unified user experience together. And what sits underneath that is logic. And that requires a ton of creativity, from the developer's point of view. So not only do I have to understand the business problem, but then I have to design an experience that makes sense to the end user, that delivers value. And that's also being written in code. And so when something isn't working in the user experience, that might be a technical solution, that might be a user experience issue, and it might be a speed to value or a value proposition. And so when all three of those, and it's really systemic for me in the diversity of thought, like the type of people that you hire, the type of people that you have on your team, the composition of those teams, whether they're technical in nature or human in nature, or, you know, more, you know, business analysts in nature, and then the diversity that you hire on your teams from around the world, depending on how big your product is, man, is that meaningful? Is it meaningful when people develop a product with more diverse thought and creativity in it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you're, you know, definitely saying things I agree with. I'm, it feels like it's, there's, I mean, a lot of management books come out, right? This is, I mean, it definitely falls in that category of business management. The language you're using, to me, just puts up red flags of a lot of spin and I'm a little concerned about the meat. I mean, I like some of the things you're saying, you know, but I'm kind of curious, like, pitch it to me because, as a difference between other business management books. Tell me what's different about this one.
I think probably the biggest difference is nobody's really written a book specifically for product management, UX design, and engineering. And maybe the way that you would organize a group of human beings much differently. So the contrast for me is waterfall product development, right? Into continuous delivery or continuous discovery. That's the biggest piece for me, is that like nobody's really talking about the problem. The problem is that we traditionally have organized our teams that really didn't deliver very effective products, and there wasn't great product market fit, and the user didn't break the tie, and there wasn't really, the process was really incomplete to me.
Okay.
It was very incomplete. It wasn't very holistic. And I think this new, at least the new emerging thing that we're really thinking about developing products, which is around this continuous delivery and discovery, which is, well, I get to go discover what the problem is.
Yeah.
And that is always happening. I'm not doing 2 deploys a year, or, I'm not doing 2 deploys a month. I'm doing 420 or 1,000 commits per month. Right. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's totally crazy. So how do you, out of curiosity, I mean, I guess it's interesting because, of course, since you're doing education, you've got to be thinking about your user all the time, because that's what education is like a direct feedback and learning, like that. It's very clear. Do you think that this idea of highly aligned the user experience as a success of everything that you're doing, does that work in a space where they're selling shoes? You know, something else, you know, like, does it relate to non-educational spaces?
Well, I probably comes back down to the human in it for me. Like, look, if I were to use the exact example that you gave, so like, a holistic learning experience, like somebody wants to be watching a course at 3 minutes and 16 seconds, and then they realize they have to go home in a commute, they close their laptop, and then they want to watch the course at 3 minutes and 17 seconds, right? And they want that native iOS, Android, Roku, Chromecast, desktop application, offline view. They want everything, right? And so like our job is to provide a really meaningful experience that, gives them everything that they need. I think in commerce, and I think learning probably is the same way. Like learning, I don't know, I'm not thinking about learning Angular 4 every second of my life.
Right.
I'm probably not thinking about buying shoes every second of my life. But when I do want to buy shoes, right, I do want to have access to buy and procure a pair of shoes probably on any platform that I use. At least I would want native iOS. I'd want my desktop application. So yeah, I think the unified experience and the personalized experience for that individual human being is really important to them. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think it makes a ton of sense for people to really think about. And I think it, I mean, what you're teasing out here is really important, because it is specific to the problem that you're solving. Like, some of those things are in time and will never occur again. Some of those things, happen 3 times or 4 times a year. They're more seasonal, and then some things like a tool. Like I was like, the tool example here is like Envision app, right? A designer sits in Envision app every single day. That's what they have to use to, that's a tool they have to use to do their job every single day. So when you're thinking about that product and like how the user experience is going to land for them, it's got to be pretty unified, man. Where, a commerce experience, well, you probably have some latitude to create there.
Yeah. Okay. So let me talk about one other thing then, since it's so important for companies and kind of your, one of your major themes of your book, so important for companies to restructure their entire business around this idea of the outcome for the user, the experience for the user, which I fully agree with you. I mean, I think it's extremely important. Of course, I'm a UI engineer, so of course I have that feeling. But in any case, to do that, to get good feedback about what is working and not for the user, you can't actually always just ask them with surveys. You can't go, send them a mailing. That kind of has been around for a long time in general for large corporations to try to figure out what they're doing with these kind of, anytime I get a survey, I'm like, well, this is a waste of time, because the people that respond to them are only a subset of your users. It doesn't necessarily represent you. But there's another way we can do that now with online services. We're doing it all the time. And unfortunately, there's this dark side of it, because massive collection of data on the user is exactly the way you find out if it's working for them or not. And, at Netflix, what people watch on the service is what we use. For your company, how people learn and what projects, what pieces of this course they actually experience, the videos, the tutorials, what code they implement, all that is looking at what they're doing really detailed, collecting that into some algorithm, and then analyzing it. And there is this wonderful potential for companies to be better aligned to serve people directly. But there's also this potential dark side of just losing the privacy and feeling all the time like you're watched. There's a darkness here. What do you think about? How do you put that in the mix?
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to be really responsible. That's the first, that's the first question. I think that's a cultural thing, personally. Like, I mean, you've got to engineer that into all the human beings that work for your company. We've got a lot of real deep thoughts around, dark UX or revenue trapping UX or anything that's crazy. You have to culturally really weed out of the organization pretty quick. I think the other thing is there's lots of angles that we can look at it. Like I always talk about it from like three cheesy principles, but like headlights, taillights, and happiness. Headlights is usage. Like we care, just like what you said, is, looking at all the utilization and usage and anonymizing that data. Like you got to anonymize it, getting picky about it isn't. And by the way, I mean, it isn't useful actually in really smaller scales, like in order for you to cover, the purpose of what you're trying to intend to do. But the other angle that that we very seldom talk about is the taillights, is billings, is what people pay. And for me, that really ends up being your core market. The people that are with high likelihood to buy and high length of stay, right, are a customer that you should deeply care about wanting to, expand, renew, and create new one of those people.
That is the whole business aspect of it being a business, right? It's getting that money. You're not a business if you don't do that part. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to create revenue. And the last piece is, for me, is happiness. Like, are customers really happy with what you've created for them? And so that kind of weeds out the dark UX side for me. Is that qualitatively, trust me, if you've done something as a company that's making a customer unhappy, you're going to hear about it, and you're not going to hear about it a little bit. You're going to hear about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you look at those three angles for me, I really can make sense of whether or not we've got something special, really, really special that people gain a lot of value from and love. And so I spend a lot of our time educating people around, building a product that really means something to someone. And the thing we started the conversation with is like, why are we even doing this? Like, what's the mission of Pluralsight? Well, the mission was to democratize technology. That's very high level. What sits behind that? Well, it's to create progress through technology that lifts the human condition. So is our product lifting the human condition? Is it giving opportunity to people that don't, equally have that opportunity? Like, that's the thing that's really meaningful that sits behind it all. So when we drive into work, do we feel connected to that mission, right? Do we actually see that mission being fulfilled for an individual human being learning something on a platform? Are they actually applying it and giving themselves a new future? To me, man, I think, we care a lot about those stories. We celebrate those stories, at Pluralsight, and our developers, along with the people on my team, we really love talking about those, those aspects of our business.
I see you're doing a pretty good job in having events and such focus around diversity. You had an event recently about celebrating women in tech. You had some stories, some headlines I noticed about trying to, I think you signed that big pledge about diversity.
Parity.org.
Yeah.
Yep.
How is that going? How hard is it to get that into the company? I mean,
yeah, it's hard.
Is there a bro culture there or what's up?
No. I think we're doing well. Around our commitment. So Pluralsight One is the initiative, and the parity.org specifically, right? Anyone above the role of a vice president, right? If we're interviewing for that role, right, you have to have a female candidate. The thing though that I would say about it the most is, for all of experience, we've kind of just rolled that out holistically. We've just not kind of pegged it at the VP role in the technology world for us. So I'll give you a great example. Like in Boston, we've got a big investment going into Boston. So any Boston folks out there, we're hiring like crazy. We're looking for like a head of data products role. And we're also trying to hire a bunch of machine learning and data scientists in those roles.
As is everybody.
Yeah, that's what yeah. I'm trying to say is yeah. that, trying to hire not only just the raw talent, and then also trying to commit yourself to parity. I mean, it makes it doubly hard, but like dude, it's just so much bigger than that. Like, if we're going to change the landscape, then yeah, it's going to be hard and you're going to be committed to it and you're going to do it. Like, we need to do this. This is something that our space needs so desperately. And like, it goes back to what I was saying, the diversity of thought. Like, we have to have all of these really great, brilliant minds that sit out there in the world today help us solve these problems, because we don't have nearly enough people thinking about them.
All right, let's talk about a fun story from your past. Why do you need a new stretcher when you're a paramedic? What was wrong? What were you solving?
Yeah, it's awesome. I love that you ended with this. So look, man, when you were an EMT, the ambulance cot is a folding ironing board. Like think about it. And healthy people don't call 911. So when you're going on like 6 to 12 calls every single day and you're using a folding ironing board and they're not super healthy, you know, what happens is you have a lot of people with back injuries and EMS. And, that was a huge problem for me. It was a huge problem for the partners that I worked with every single day. You had a bunch of my partners go to light duty because of those back injuries, and it ended their career. I mean, it absolutely ended their careers.
You're talking about two, and I'm assuming there's like two paramedics in the ambulance.
Yep.
And then you come in and you run into someone who's had some trouble and they weigh 350 pounds. And that means that you're hoisting, well, if you're the downstairs person in the staircase, you're hoisting a lot of that weight on your back, and that's not good for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, ambulance cot weighs 90 pounds. A patient weighs 300, well, 200. Average weight of a, you know, patient was 250 to 310 pounds, and you're doing that 6 to 12 times a day. And that's, just think about how many times you do it.
Must wreck you.
Yeah, you load it in the back of the ambulance. You unload it out of the back of the ambulance. You reload it, right? I mean, there's just tons of, and like that doesn't count, like, you know, taking someone down a flight of stairs and out to the ambulance. So, yeah, there's a better way to solve that. The first one was the Paraslide, which is a hospital evacuation sled. The second one was Power Pro, a powered ambulance cot. And the last one was a stair chair, which is a chair with the tracks on the back of it. So we eliminated, 80% of the injuries and fire EMS in, roughly a 7-year time frame. It was a huge...
Does that mean you basically put somebody in like a wheelchair instead of in a cot to transport them?
Yeah, so... Yeah, if they're like in a 2-story apartment with no elevator, which is common, or 3 stories, right? You would take this 40-pound foldable chair, mm-hmm. and then you would unfold it, and then on the back of that chair was a set of tank tracks, and it just zipped straight down the stairs instead of us carrying a dining room chair down a flight of stairs. And then the ambulance cot was powered off of hydraulics and a 24-volt DeWalt battery, and so it lifts 750 pounds up, so you'd never have to lift and lower a patient ever again.
So it was like a truck lift, but just kind of built into the thing.
Yeah, exactly right. Nice. Yeah, and then the last one was a Paraslide, which is a hospital evacuation sled. If there's a fire inside of a hospital, the way that nurses were doing that was by carrying patients 3-point on a sheet. They go to 3 points of a sheet, put a patient on it, and then 8 flights down a flight of stairs. And you can only imagine if you've got like critical care patients.
And the manpower it takes to do that, 3 people have to carry each individual out. That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Then they got to hike up 8 flights. Well, it was 2004 that a company got acquired in 2009. And then I ran global R&D there until the beginning of 2012.
Were you a founder of it?
No. Yeah. So Paramed, yes. Yeah. I was the founder and CEO of Paramed and then sold it to a Fortune 1.
So when you left that, how'd you end up getting to Pluralsight?
Well, the origin story at Stryker was cool because it was hardware and then it was IoT. Like, we really did some pretty amazing IoT, like the ambulance cot, the powered ambulance cot. We did a lot of low energy Bluetooth, RFID, really fun innovations that, that space had never seen happen before.
Yeah.
And then that's really where the whole passion and love came for software. So from there, I started a product development company called Brightface. We launched about 44 web applications in 3 years, a lot of full stack Rails apps, man. That was when Rails was the hotness back
then.
Sure,
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then went through another acquisition there, and then was recruited at OC Tanner. They're a 90-year-old company. They were going through a huge transformation, like really old tech stack, like 16-year old tech stack.
So you had to dive in, try to change that. Was that difficult?
Yeah, that was so I would say Stryker, at Stryker, I was kind of called a social anarchist there. Like, I was young, I was, really hungry to want to really just, innovate within that company. And I didn't realize how a $9 billion company operates. Our business unit was like $1.2 billion that year. So it was a different ball game completely. So I'd say I wasn't as successful as I would have liked to have been at Stryker, but OC Tanner, very successful. Like, we did a lot of really great things there. And plus the mission of the company, man. I mean, it's recognition and appreciating other human beings for what they do great. And so it was a really fun product problem to solve. It was great alignment. I love Dave Peterson, their CEO. I'd stand in front of a bus today for that guy. He was an incredible leader.
Why'd you leave?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, like, look at the cause of Pluralsight. You know, it's education. So I have a real sweet spot in my heart for education. And I think just the sheer impact you can have by touching, you know, so many different people around the world, I think Pluralsight has the best shot at it. And so it's a very inspirational mission.
Do you have courses on ethics?
Well, ethical hacking.
Okay.
How's that? Does that count?
Yeah, at some level.
I have no idea. I should look into the library. I have no idea.
Yeah, it seems like a very challenging problem. There's a lot of bro culture kind of stuff going on, and that's a lot of that's about not thinking about how you think and not thinking about how you react. And I think that we kind of need a bit more of that in the dev space.
Yeah, I love that idea, man. I actually have no idea. I should look into the library. I really want to spend time with you. I'd love to see what you see around that, because
I'd love to take a look at your library. I haven't done it in a while.
Yeah.
Do you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence? He's used with permission of GeekSpeak Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use it any way you'd like. Just give us credit.
I did not know that.
Did you know that the theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music? The book is Product Leadership, How Top Product Managers Launch Awesome Products and Build Successful Teams. Our guest today is Nate Walkershaw. He is the Chief Experience Officer at Pluralsight. And Nate, thank you so much for being on the show with me. Was there anything you wanted to add before signing off?
No, I mean, the only other places for like really great content, I've written a ton of stuff on Medium. That's where I've kind of put my heart and my soul, and just giving away as much free resources as I can around really the topics that you talked about, man, like the stuff I care most about.
What's your Medium handle?
NWalkingShaw.
Well, Nate Walkingshaw, I'm sure you can see him on Twitter at NWalkingShaw, and also, of course, on Medium, where he posts a lot about these ideas. Thank you, Nate, so much for talking to me. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, well, my pleasure as well.
All right, I think we got that hour. Thanks for sticking with me.
Yeah, dude. Good job. It went dark there for a minute. I thought it was good, though, man.
I had to get it dark because we need to get into the... I think you've got a lot of passion for humanity in a lot of what you're saying. And it was nice to see that that's not just talking points. Like, your ability to react on that kind of tougher question about data collection and stuff, I thought was a pretty good way of thinking about it. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, I was wondering where you're going at first, but it was actually a really great push.
Great. Thanks.
Yep. Well, let's stay close, dude. I really would love to double click into what you see around ethics, man.
Yeah, I've got an interesting.
Would you mind summarizing? I would love if you'd summarize maybe some of your thoughts. It would be. I'd really like to hear what to say
about which,
like what you see around the bro culture. Like, if you were to do an ethics, like if you were to build content for ethics, like what would we do?
I think one of the things would be is kind of one of this, the perfect world is that every developer kind of gets an example. Okay, so here's the tenet of why I'm thinking about this. And that is that we see really bad mistakes happening from companies where they get in a lot of trouble by doing something stupid.
Yeah.
And they did that something stupid. We can probably suss out why that happened is because an engineer was able to do it. And somebody up high was like, we should do this thing. And the engineer solved it with this. Mm-hmm. And those things didn't align to the actual possible badness and the goodness, right?
Yeah.
And it was about probably communication between those people or those groups.
Yeah.
And so if there was this kind of ethical foundations aspect that people could have a language around it, an easier language around it, and I think this is emerging out of mistakes that have been made, right? Just like our field is gaining this knowledge because when we screw up, it's so bad for the company. But it would be interesting to have a earlier pre-discussion that kind of infuses, like, why are you doing what you're doing? What benefit to the world is it? Is it important to do something? Is it ever okay to do something because it's your job?
Yeah.
And is it ever okay to say no because you're a human? And where does that line land when your salary's in play?
Yeah.
And your way of life's in play? And these are really challenging questions. But
yep.
If you don't think about it, it's very easy to go, well, I have no knowledge in that space and I'm being told what to do and somebody else can think about it for me. If you have a little bit more knowledge in that, I think it allows you to think better as a person.
Yeah, makes total sense, dude.
And I think all this aligns with happiness at a company, too. I think that if you think you're doing right things and good things, it feels better to work there. But that's a little bit of my analysis. I don't know a lot about it, but cool. Great, Nate. Thanks,
man.
All right, take care.
Bye.